Welcome back to TechNet Radio. Matt Hester kicks off his 8-part Infrastructure as a Service series, and in today's episode, he welcomes Chief Technical Evangelist for the Cloud, Brian Prince, to the show as they give us an overview of Microsoft's IaaS platform, aka Windows Azure Virtual Machines. Tune in as they build a case for why both developers and IT professionals should consider using this service, as well as how to get started and create your own Azure Virtual Machine in minutes. Matt, the mic is yours.
Hey, good afternoon, good morning, or good evening, everybody. Thank you for dialing into this TechNet webcast. Today, we're going to talk about Windows Azure IaaS, which, as you're listening to this, should be just right around the corner so everybody will get their hands on the final bits and everything that's going to be into the product. But we also have on the show today, we have the wonderfully talented Brian Prince. So, Brian, why don't you tell folks a little bit about who you are and what you do and why we're going to talk about Azure IaaS, because if people know you, you're not an IT pro officially.
Not officially, no. So, but you know, I have played one on TV before. Early in my startup career, you know, any small business, you end up playing a lot of different roles. So, I probably fit into the DevOp category, and do a lot of software architecture. For right now, I'm the chief evangelist for cloud for Microsoft. So, I do what you do, but I do it to architects and software developers.
Yeah, and you brought up a term that not a lot of people, I think it's kind of getting new or they're starting to understand DevOps. You know, and me being an IT pro evangelist and working about the infrastructure, how would you describe DevOps? Because I kind of describe it as the hybrid evangelist, or the hybrid job, right? You got to know a little bit about code. You got to know a little bit about infrastructure to be able to tell that whole story.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically what it is. And it's traditionally, but it's kind of ironic since the role is the term hasn't been around that long. But normally you see that in small and medium organizations where you have to wear a lot of different hats. And a DevOp is usually someone who with a software development background but does a lot of infrastructure work, or the opposite. They have an infrastructure background and they're just working very closely with a development team. Generally have strong skills in scripting. So that and it really has nothing directly to do with the cloud. So maybe their whole environment they're managing through PowerShell and a lot of scripts and automation and virtual environments. They know how to talk to developers. That's really important. So there's just a lot of crossover skills there. And that's where DevOps have come from.
Yeah, and I think from a standpoint, something you and I were talking about before we hopped on this, and part of the reason the cloud's important is because nowadays with the technology, it used to be, you know, developers would throw the code over the wall to the IT pro to say, go deploy my code. Well, now the wall is I'm throwing it up to the cloud, which is kind of a shared environment that we all need to be aware of. And I think the cloud is driving that kind of, you know, Scott Hanselman used to tell me it used to be this bright, shiny line between IT pros and developers, and they were kind of this camp that never the twain shall meet, right? And what happened is that line has become fuzzy and it's become really kind of reduced, and the cloud has really helped do that. So when you talk to dev teams, what's one thing that's really important for them that you always talk to them about?
Well, it's interesting you bring up that bright line. I've always believed is the closer you can partner with your IT pro as a developer, the more benefit you're going to get out of that relationship. I've worked on product teams where literally you haven't even started gathering requirements yet, and IT needs your server requirements because it takes them 6 months to buy servers and get them ready and rack them and all of that. And you end up lying to each other. And, you know, because you're guessing, you don't know. And then you don't even see them until 6 months later. And then, surprise, here's a bunch of bits, go make it work. And that, you know, that kind of worked in the old waterfall days. But in the agile frame that we have now, you have to work very closely with those people all the time. You know, development is a team sport. It's not just a team of developers. It's a team of developers and project managers and testers and infrastructure teams and people like that, customers, to really build awesome software. The more integrated you can be with those infrastructure guys to begin with, I think the better everything will be.
And that's kind of what brings us to the conversation today around Azure and IaaS and what we're doing from an infrastructure as a service perspective, not only help, you know, us out from IT pros from having a back-end perspective of our own virtualized systems up in the cloud, but also being able to give an environment that's that quick and easy. You know, when we talk about being able to stand up virtual machines, Brian and I will often tell you, you know, 10 to 15 minutes, you have a brand new virtual machine running an OS that's yours. And we're not making that up. It's not the 6-month delay anymore. We're talking 10 to 15 minutes, and I have a full infrastructure environment. And it goes kind of that conversation of, you know, pick whatever month it is. Well, we're in April, right? So tax month right here in the U.S. Yep. Well, what happens? What if you're one of the IT directors for one of the many tax companies up there, and you have just on-premise data center? You have to guess. You have to guess at how big your workload's going to be. And if you guess wrong, that's a bad day. If you guess right, great, you solved the problem for this month. What about next month? What about next year? And that's where cloud services have really evolved. And so Azure IaaS has kind of changed the game from what we have. And from this perspective, it's kind of an age-old lesson. And I'm going to give full credit, because for those of you who've seen me talk about this before, and I've talked about it on radio shows before, we actually learned this lesson back in the days of Edison and Tesla, didn't we, Brian?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, and I'll tell you, I learned this story from a book called Devil in the White City. It's about the Chicago World's Fair, and I don't know, what was it, 1893 or something like that. It's also the story of the first real serial killer in the U.S. So it's kind of has a dark edge to it, but we won't go into that part of it.
That's nice and cheerful for today.
Yeah, there you go. And it's really about, you know, the Chicago World's Fair needed some way to one-up Paris and their whole Eiffel Tower thing. And this is in the day when cities were dark and lit by oil lanterns everywhere, and it wasn't safe to really go out at night. And so they decided that this whole electricity thing was going to be their big shtick. So they decided they were going to light the World's Fair. And like all IT projects, actually, the World's Fair project team had only maybe half of the amount of time and half the amount of budget they needed to pull this fair off, which reminds me about every project I've ever been on.
Yeah, our budgets aren't going up anytime in the near future.
Yeah, I have
more with less.
I've yet to have a project that had too much money or too much time. There's always too much scope. But so they built all these buildings with white walls, either marble or marble-like facades or white stucco, things like that. And they were going to light the World's Fair. And so they went to Edison and they asked him, hey, you know, can you light the World's Fair? And he says, sure, we'll have to build a generator and we have to put all these light bulbs in and string all this wire. And he gave them a bid. And I wish I could remember the number. Do you remember the number off the top of your head?
Yeah, because I stole the story from you. So
yeah.
It was $2 million. But think about it, folks. If you're an Edison customer, no matter what you did, whether you were lighting the Chicago World Fair or you made socks, you were also in the generator business, right, Brian? You had
yeah.
to have people that knew how to maintain the generator. You had to have spare parts and all that stuff.
Well, yeah, you had to have you had to buy the generator, install it, have spare parts, fuel, train people, probably buy a support contract. And so, like you said, if you're now not just in the sock business or the newspaper business, you're also in the generator business. And that was just too much money. That's not $2 million adjusted to our modern economy. That was $2 million in 1893 money, which was a huge, huge number. So they asked him, boy, could you, you know, is there a discount? Come on, you know, help us out. And he came right back and he lowered it to what? $50,000?
$400,000 or something.
$400,000, yeah, that's right. 75% discount.
This is your story, man.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, it's all in slides. And it's hard to trust someone who gives you a 75% discount like that. You know, you wonder what's going on. So they turned to Tesla, who had he actually didn't invent alternating current. Someone else did, but he figured out how to make it work. He figured out the brushless rotor and all of that. So he came up with the technology that made alternating current work. Edison and all his stuff was all direct current, which is why it was very short range, on premises, those sort of things. So they went to Tesla, and he said, oh, yeah, we can do it for a fraction of that cost. Again, a couple $100,000. They, you know, and his gig was, don't sell you the hardware. His gig was he will build efficient power generation facilities wherever power is most easily made, so by a waterfall or a coal mine or a naturally occurring black hole or something like that. And then alternating current would allow him to ship that at distance to the customer. So you could you build a factory in Niagara Falls and ship that power to New York City so that you have a more efficient power grid. Then you're buying a service instead of buying a product. You're buying electricity like we do today instead of buying a power generator.
Yep.
And that's really where it happened. And Edison and Tesla had worked for Edison at a time, and there was a lot of going back and forth between them and fighting. And because of this, Edison revoked his light bulb patent from Tesla, his license. So Tesla had to reinvent the light bulb. I think it took him a couple of days, came up with a different way to make a light bulb so that they could light the World's Fair. And so with this power and all these lights, it did two things. One, it allowed people to stay at the World's Fair a lot longer than you normally would. You would go home at dusk, and now they could stay until 10 o'clock at night. So now they're serving dinner. They're making a lot more money with people staying there longer and that sort of thing. So that was important. That's one reason why they did this. And the second is this is the first time in human history that miles and miles and miles away you could look into the distance and see a giant beam of light coming up out of the darkness. And that was Chicago. And so that's one reason why one of Chicago's nicknames is the White City, because you see this giant beam of light from so far away.
Well, and that, I think – go ahead.
No, and that parallels really what's happening to our industry today. If I'm a health insurance company, I'm a health insurance company, and I'm in the business of insurance. I mean, I'm insurance, and I'm in
well,
the business. Of, yeah, in the business of data centers, and that's not my reason for being. And so, the cloud helps remove that. There are always going to be things that I think will be in your own data center, things that are so important to your business that you can't possibly let them go. I think that footprint will be smaller and smaller every year as we go forward. But there are lots of things that are just nuisances, email, portals, websites, things like that that are important to a company, but they're not strategic to a company.
Yeah, and I think that's when you talk about the cloud, the analogy, and that's why I love the story, and thank you for telling it again, is just a wonder. I mean, it's just a great story because it's a wonderful analogy what we have, but more importantly, you know, we still have generators in our facilities. We still have generators for the necessity of backup, whereas in IT, there's going to be things that never, ever go to the cloud service. You know, my favorite example is Coca-Cola. Up until relatively recent ago, Coca-Cola's formula is on a piece of paper in a vault, and matter of fact, I just followed up on this. It's actually in a vault in the Coca-Cola Museum in Atlanta, Georgia. So you still can't even see it. It's, you know, secreted away because that's things that's vital to Coca-Cola as an industry and as a company. By the way, they have a case study. They use cloud technologies as well. But when we talk about Azure IaaS and we talk about it, things have kind of changed the game a bit because, Brian, you come from we all come from the initial world of Azure, which was PaaS, Platform as a Service, where we basically told your developers, don't worry about the infrastructure. We got you. Just write your code like you're going to write it to any Windows server and stick it up on our virtual machine, and we'll help you scale it all out. We created this thing that solves, you know, time travel called the Fabric Controller that allows people to work with these types of things. So when we think about PaaS versus IaaS, Brian, how do you kind of differentiate between folks? I mean, I know you and I talk about IT Pro versus that, and I think, well, IaaS is mine, but it's really kind of both of ours. And really PaaS, I look at it, even though I don't write code, it's still kind of mine because somebody has to manage or maintain that or connect that infrastructure to our on-premise. So how do you talk about or differentiate between PaaS and IaaS for the folks that you come in with, whether it's an IT Pro or developer or your mom or dad?
Well, I first start with reminding IT pros that their job isn't to back up tapes. Their job isn't to cut cables. Their job is to make sure the company has the right resources at the right time. The cloud's just an easier way to do that. So it's not necessarily, you know, what they may be doing on a day-to-day basis may change, but it's the value they bring is knowing what services and what infrastructure you need at the right time and to get rid of it when you don't need it anymore. So when I compare IaaS and PaaS together, IaaS is about bringing your own VMs, and PaaS is about bringing your own code. And then if we look at SaaS, Software as a Service, which is the next step over, the next abstraction layer higher, that's about bringing your users. You're not even controlling the infrastructure or the code. You're just using a service. So generally speaking, IaaS is easier for migrating a workload. And a lot of times we'll call this lift and shift because the workload is often already virtualized and we can take those VHDs, move them to the cloud, do some networking stuff in Azure to maybe connect that network back to the corporate data center, and you're done, right? It's, you know, and it's easy to do to even just try it over a weekend, because you can just throw it out when you're done. You don't have to destroy the old server just trying that out. PaaS is stronger when you're building a new system, and you can build it with PaaS in mind. And so I can say, you know, we're going to really break our code down in these logical units. This is the dimension of scale and the unit of scale, and kind of build that into the system and know that I don't have any legacy software components that I have to make special scripts for or something like that. So I think IaaS is then easier to get into the cloud with, but you're only maybe getting half as much of the value out of the cloud, right? Because you still have to manage those servers like normal servers. You have to worry about their hopes and dreams. You have to hold them tight at night, all of those sort of things to make sure that they're running in a healthy manner.
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of people think, you know, it's something, you throw something in the cloud, it's just magically going to get better. Well, in PaaS, it does to some extent, because it gets magically scalable, right? The Fabric Controller helps us do that. With IaaS, though, it's like any other server. It's just virtualized. And, oh, by the way, you don't even have the hardware. It's running up in our data centers for people to work with it. So you have to maintain that, work with it, update it, and shift it. But also, when you think about the PaaS environment versus IaaS, one thing I always, when developers do ask me the questions, and I get asked occasionally, is, well, I need to make a change in this PaaS server. Maybe I need to configure IIS in a certain way or configure something in the underlying OS. And there was really no easy way in PaaS to make that change permanent, right? It was stateless. So if we made a change and that VM got reset in the Azure environment, in the PaaS environment specifically, we had to redo those changes or script those changes to come back if the server rebooted. Well, with IaaS, this is your server, so you get to configure it. You get your version of the OS. You have to update it. You have to back up. You have to treat it. You have to join it to your domains, just like we would any other virtualized environment. And the difference here, though, and this is one of these things, a standpoint of what I tell a lot of IT pros, hey, you want to try Windows Server 2012, and you might do this for your developers. You want to try 2012 or write some code to it? What if I said you could have a server in 15 minutes that's ready to go for you to start playing with? Yeah. And I think that's what people forget, is the quickness of the cloud. And by the way, I'm not making that up, and there's even a 90-day trial, so it doesn't even cost you a penny. Or if you have MSDM benefits, you can activate your hours through there, and it's something that's built into those things. It may not even cost you a penny to go out and try fully functional software to work with.
Well, and it's disposable. So a lot of people are like, hey, do you think this will work? And I'm like, I don't know. Try it.
Yep.
Load up a server and just do it. And, you know, you spend an afternoon doing it, and then you know, versus getting someone's opinion off of some forum on the internet, just do it and then throw it away when you're done. Just delete it all. It, you know. So I think it's amazing that we have this great disposable environment now that we can leverage. Back to you, you know, it's tax month here in the U.S., and I can guarantee that probably – my good instinct is 90% of the taxes are filed on the last 48 hours of the tax window.
Imagine trying to make the data center for that.
Yeah, well, exactly. And what do you do on April 16th? Correct. Right? Because your spike goes from incredibly high to nothing overnight. And so you spent all of your budget on these servers. You spent months tuning them and getting them ready and dealing with the pressures of having – such a huge spike in such a short period of time. At least you know it's coming. And then it just goes away and doesn't come back for another 10 months. And now you have all this hardware just sitting around, chewing up space, chewing up air conditioning and power and all of that, you know.
Well, and that's where IaaS comes in. I mean, that's where it really sings to work with it. Also, you know, you mentioned Dev and Test is a great way to look at Azure IaaS learning tool. And, you know, disposable is one way I think about it. I also think of it as portable. I think what's great about our, whether you use PaaS or especially with IaaS, you don't want to run it in the cloud anymore. You don't want to pay for that service. It's your VHD. You can bring it back down into your premise data center and basically kind of get rid of it and not have to worry about those types of things. I don't have to commit. I'm not stuck in Azure when I use my workloads. The workloads are very portable. They're very disposable. You can move them in and out at whatever you want to do. It's one of my favorite marketing terms that I normally don't kind of like our marketing terms, but cloud on your terms means that. It means, how do you define it? How do you use it? How are you going to leverage it? And how do you get those tools that are out there?
Well, we do that exact thing. If you know our WhackWhack performance tool, Yep. And for those that don't know, Microsoft, we do performance reviews twice a year, and everyone in the company does it at the same time. And
about 48 hours before they're due.
Yeah, and it's just like taxes, right? Everyone does it right before it's due. And if you think of the one at the end of the fiscal year is the more important of the two. And so, but outside of those review periods, very little load is put on that system. A couple of HR people, maybe a manager looking up your history, very little load. So that's a VHD that we run internal to our data center 90% of the time. And during these two spikes, these predictable spikes, we move that to Azure and we scale it up. We put it on bigger hardware. We allocate 8 cores to it instead of 2 or 1. And then when that spike is over, they move it back down to on-premises. So they can bounce that VHD around all they want, and the VHD doesn't care. It's just it just looks like a reboot.
Yeah, and the only thing you have to worry about is, you know, this is the one thing I joke with IT pros. Everybody's like, well, how big's your VHD? Oh, it's about 10 gig. Well, 10 gig's not so bad. We'll upload 10 gig up to the internet, right? Yeah. It's an upload of 10 gig, right? We're kind of stuck to whatever that bandwidth up and down is going to work with it.
Yeah.
So when we think about this, what I'd like to be able to show you now is actually how to create an Azure IaaS environment, how quick it is to set up. I mean, it's one thing for Brian and I to show you and talk about the value of the cloud, but also another thing to actually show you how it technically works. So one of the things that Brian and I have talked about is how quick it is to get involved with the cloud. So if you've activated your trials, or if you have a 90-day trial, or if you activate your MSDN subscriptions, you actually get functionality of the entire cloud. And what I'm just going to show you here is a little bit of the infrastructure as a service piece to kind of show you how easy it is to get up and running inside of here. So I'm going to go ahead and create a brand new virtual machine, and we have this nice obvious button called New. So I'm going to go click on New. It's going to ask me, what do I want to create? Now, I've signed up for the virtual machine preview role, and once again, hopefully by the time you're listening to this, you should know that it's right around the corner, hopefully. It won't much longer be in preview, we hope. But I'm going to go ahead and click on virtual machine, and that's going to ask me what I want to do. I'm going to do from gallery so I can step you through the entire wizard as we go through it. Quick create just gives you a quick little menu option, and you type in some things done. So as I go through this, one thing I want you to notice is working through this tools that we have a bunch of images that are here from Windows Server 2008 R2. We have one that has fully baked SQL Server 2012. So we have templates that are already pre-built that give you a certain kind of OS. And in the case of the Windows Server 2012 data center one, the one that I'm actually going to choose here, is that it's just a pre-baked operating system. There's nothing there. So if you want to install Active Directory, or if you want to install DNS or one of the other many roles, with the exception of Hyper-V and a couple of other things, you can do so very, very easily right from here. Now, you also are looking at this list from as an IT pro perspective. Wait a second. Matt, aren't you a Microsoft employee? I'm like, yeah, but look at the bottom five that we have here. We have open source systems. We talk about cloud on your terms. As much as Brian and I would love for you to say that you're 100% Microsoft, we know in reality that a lot of our customers and a lot of people listening to this thing are in mixed environments. And Azure has those components to help you make those kind of pre-canned decisions of what OS do you need to use and maintain that's specific to your environment. For our demo today, I'm going to go ahead and choose 2012 Data Center. I'm going to go ahead and click on Next. And it's going to ask me what I want to create, what version of do I want to set up. Notice we have different versions, basically kind of, Brian, as I described, this is kind of what the operating system looked like on February 12, 2013. So if there's any patches that have come out since then, you want to make sure you're aware. Generally, I recommend that you stay at this level, whatever the most current is, especially if you're making a new machine. Brian, do you have any guidance for that kind of choice of why somebody might deprecate their system back a few updates past?
Well, I know from a legacy software perspective, you might have dependencies or, you know, in sophisticated IT environments, they often have very strict server hygiene. And there might be a newer patch or a new BIOS level, but we know this set works. And until we do a full round of testing on the next version, we're going to keep it as it is. And so that way you don't get server drift. If I spin up 5 servers, and the first 4 were in the February build, I don't want to make the 5th the March build and have some weirdness happen.
Yeah,
so that lets me kind of keep them all consistent.
Consistent, and then update them consistently as the need arises as well. So
yep.
So I give it a name. It's your server, and this is going
to be... Now, does it have to be cryptic like that?
No, well, that's my initials. Well, and it doesn't necessarily have to be cryptic, but it does have to be unique, and this helps me with the cloudapp.net domain, which I'm going to ask you about in just a second because I'm sure you have a fun story on that one. We have to give it a password for the administrative account. This password follows complex password rules, so you have to have upper and lowercase characters and a combination of numbers and letters for your actual password as well.
I think it has to include a prime number.
Oh, password provide is not allowed. Now, notice what we did here. I actually put in a common password. Some of you might just say, you know what, I'm just going to make it password one or make it some variation of password. We actually, not only in our data centers, protect on the outside. We have very hard and crunchy on the data centers. We also make it very hard for the average bear. So whenever you make this password, folks, you want to make sure that you create something that is unique, that's not something that can be easily guessed. But, Brian, that's the same rule we have in our regular data centers today, isn't it?
Yeah. Yep.
Oops. And if I can actually type in the same password twice, I'll be all right.
Oh, come on. You have the same password I have. Mine's all dots as well.
Yeah, it's all dots. And let me make sure I get this right today. When I look at the Windows Azure passwords that are here, you have to get them right. If you get them wrong, you're going to have to restart the whole process. But once again, from soup to nuts, this only takes about 10 to 15 minutes to provision a box. Now, you have a choice here of how big is the system going to be used. Now, if you're just kicking the tires with Azure, small should be perfectly fine for you. But based on workload, you're going to choose a different kind of level of what you have here. But beware, just like kind of what happens is when you think about when you choose a larger system, you're going to be consuming more resources. And in our case, the meter is going to be spinning a little bit faster for you. So when you look at the costs of Azure, it's all a commodity, right, to some extent. It's all this compute power. And the larger systems that you choose, the more you're going to be billed for that. When you're looking at just trials or kicking the tires, small should be perfectly fine. But maybe you're making your own SQL environment or doing some analytics. That's where you might go to large environments or things that have big data inside of it. We are incredibly scalable, incredibly powerful, but really it's going to depend on what workload. Most customers I work with are just kicking the tires, so I'm going to choose the small and click on Next. It's going to ask me for a DNS name, and I'm just going to use the same cryptic password that Brian doesn't seem to like, the cloudapp.net. Now, folks, this is what we have, Microsoft. And Brian, maybe you can give some insight. Why did we choose cloudapp.net, or is that just because it was only the only one available?
That was because it was available. So the virtual server name you did earlier, that's kind of the NetBIOS name.
Yep.
And that has to be unique within your own Azure network.
Correct.
But in my subscription, I could set up a server with the same name. The DNS name has to be globally unique. That's kind of the publicly addressable name. And all of our services actually have some sort of root domain name like cloudapp.net that you can then wrap with CNAMEs in your own DNS if you want.
Yeah, so it can be yourcompany.com. But if you see something ever on the web in the wild that says cloudapp.net, I can guarantee you that's an Azure application, whether it's an IaaS app or another thing, we can talk about it. Yeah. Notice also I have the choice. Right now I'm making a standalone machine, but I have the choice to connect this to another existing virtual machine. And what this does, if I choose this, it gives me a list of other virtual machines I want to connect it to, and it wires them together in a service. So this is kind of a quick and easy and dirty way to network your systems together so that I can communicate with other virtual machines inside of my infrastructure as a service. Past that, when you do a standalone, it kind of isolates them. It kind of sandboxes them in a way. But if you're making your first one, you're going to choose standalone. And then after that, if you want them to network, one of the ways is to connect. But that's just one of the ways. You can also stand up and create your own virtual networks inside of Windows Azure IaaS and set up your own kind of DNS records as well and essentially create your own virtual network with your own set of IPs. You're going to get assigned an IP address when this creates. But I'm going to go ahead and just do a standalone for now and just give it a name. That should resolve. I have a storage account. Where am I actually going to put the VHD files? Brian, I get asked this question a lot. I'm going to ask it to you because it's always a fun answer. You know, why would I choose multiple storage accounts? I know for ease of provisioning might be one way, but why not just use the same storage account?
Well, a storage account is just a simple container of data, and we have governors placed on that container that limit the number of simultaneous reads and writes that you can do. So that we can spread performance out. So often you will put each, especially in a production environment, I would split each server into its own storage container, storage account, so that it doesn't bump up against that that resource governor. It's just like if you throw a ton of VHDs on a SAN, you're all yep. hitting that same data bus. It's the same thing. And this allows us also to we dynamically move these storage pieces around to get the best performance possible. And by having them broken out like that, it makes it easier for us to do that. So you get better performance as well.
Okay. So better performance is one way. But at the end of the day, the bill's the same, right? It's just all about how yep. we can logically set that up. Then yep. I get to control where those systems are stored from a regional perspective, or I use affinity groups. Now, when we talk about affinity groups, it's kind of like making your own service, isn't it, Brian?
Yeah, affinity groups are really just a shortcut, so you don't have to remember where you put all your crap. You can, and the other thing is that lets us and our fabric controller know these things are going to be running together, and so they should be more co-located within a data center. So actually each region that we have listed there, many of those actually have multiple data centers. And if you don't create an affinity group and you just happen to pick the same region, let's say on your database and your server, they'll be in the same region, but they could potentially be in different data centers within that region, which yep. is fast, but faster would be if they were in the same data center and perhaps even next to each other in that data center. And that's what affinity groups let us know.
And that allows to control kind of where that data may go, because you may have rules inside your organization that say, hey, the data can't go outside the U.S. Or the data can't go outside of Europe if you happen to be a European customer. So affinity groups help you kind of control that workload, and that's what they're there for. And as Brian will tell you, I think the last official statement I heard is that Brian and I can tell you anywhere in the world there's between 10 and 100 data centers officially. I know of only 6 off the top of my head, and I'm stretching just to get to 6. So I think that's
that we own as a company. That we there own. Are 8 that we talk about. For Windows Azure, we have several more probably in the next 12, 18 months coming online for Azure as well.
So we have this huge dynamic environment, which, by the way, from an infrastructure standpoint, I always like to talk to people because it's one of those things that I think Microsoft, unfairly, in my opinion, has gotten beat up about scalability. These are all running Windows, most likely 2008 R2 core, and some of them hopefully are being upgraded. I don't know what the status of the data center. They don't tell Brian and I the status, but hopefully they're 2012 core servers as well. So this is running on Microsoft's Hyper-V technologies on the back end, supporting, gigantic number of computers. And what's the number of how many servers are actually in a data center in the mega data centers, like 250,000 or something silly like that?
And one of them, they're not all the same size, but one of them, for example, is 360,000 servers, and that's just in one of the data centers in that region.
And imagine that. Imagine being able to tie into that as an IT pro or as even a dev and test, be able to get some of that scalability of stuff that you may not have the resources to do, and that's what the cloud provides. We talk about availability sets. This is where you can kind of get those availability sets. I'm not going to worry about creating one here. I'm just going to click on Next to complete the wizard, and it's going to start provisioning the box. Now, folks, this is one of those things I would like to stress one word to everybody listening: patience. This takes about 10 to 15 minutes. Let it go. It's going to take 10 to 15 minutes. You're going to see starting like you're seeing here. You're going to see stopped. You're going to see all kinds of different status of this virtual machine. Let it just run. Be patient with it. And I see this a lot with IT pros. I've also seen it with developers, especially in our PaaS offering, when they're provisioning virtual machines and deploying their code. Or compiling might take them 15 minutes, whereas used to be before took them a little bit longer. So, Brian, any other words other than patience when this process is occurring that you'd like to tell people about?
Yeah, exactly, patience. And do not try to connect to it before it's ready, because you'll pollute your DNS cache. That can be frustrating to troubleshoot if you don't know about that. And the cool stuff that's going on is we have, like, unicorns and leprechauns just running around crazy in our data center right now.
Yep.
We're finding this hardware is turned off when we're not using it. That's how we get such a good PUE. And
wait. Define PUE.
Power utilization efficiency. So it's the ratio of critical power, meaning power that's specifically used to do the to run the servers, so the ratio of critical power to overhead power. The power consumed by battery backup, air conditioners, things like that. All of the power that doesn't really directly do with the server. And a typical data center, the one with your raised floor and all of that, is probably in the 2 to 2.5, maybe even 3.0 range, meaning for every kilowatt of electricity you're using on the servers, you're burning another one or two of those just on the environment for the servers. And our data centers are down in the 1.2 to 1.4 range, which is amazingly low. And it's because we keep unused servers turned off.
Yeah.
And so, right now, it's looking for a server that meets the requirements that you asked for, the affinity groups, all of that stuff. And it's turning it on. It's deploying the image. It's configuring everything. It's turning on, you know, configuring DNS and load balancers and the VLAN and the switches and all of that stuff, right? And that's what takes the 15 minutes.
Yep, and you can see, even though it looked like it was stopped, folks, and that's why I was glad Brian told the story, because I wanted to make sure you got to that point, because you're going to see it stopped. I guarantee you're going to want to do something. Don't. Just relax. Go get a cup of coffee and chill. Now, I'm going to let it go ahead and do its job, but one of the things we can actually do is, as I come into it, what is called the dashboard view of this particular virtual machine, and we just now started putting in some information around documentation. You have PowerShell. So PowerShell is fully supported in this environment, so you can PowerShell up into your cloud and work with it. But a couple important things I want to show you real quick, and then we'll sign off for the day. The first, the dashboard. I'm not really worried about what's happening right now, but notice what happens here is when I create this, I get my the host name it's running on, the DNS name. I also get the public and private, or the internal IP address that's there for us to work with it. Now, notice I don't have an RDB certificate thumbprint. I'm still in the process of provisioning the system, but that gets all created the minute I work with this. Now, when you first stand up a virtual system inside of Windows Azure, how do you connect to it? Endpoints are part of it. Notice it's even telling me, hey, provisioning is in progress. Don't do anything, right? Wait for it to do what it's done, or you could corrupt things, and it just can be, it's more, nothing's really broken. You just got to wait for things to clear out the cache, or you have to clear it out by hand. And work with it. But endpoints is how we connect to it. And how I like to think of endpoints is kind of the firewall in front of Azure. Even though we have a Windows 2012 operating system being built that has its own firewall, I kind of like to think of the endpoints as there's no way to get to this virtual machine except via that port. Now, from a security standpoint, this is kind of an interesting point, because that's a common port. These are common things that people might try to scan. With PowerShell, you can add and remove the endpoints as you need them. But more from a functional standpoint, not so much a security standpoint, what if I was standing up a web server? How would I do that? Well, I'd simply create another endpoint to make that occur. Now, I can't create the endpoint right now because the provisioning is still occurring, but I did that with IIS1. I actually made an endpoint for a web port, because I wanted this to be a front-end web server that I could configure and work with it, and I just basically gave it the public port of port 80. Well, Matt, what if I wanted HTTPS? That's port 443. So really, the endpoints are how you basically get your Azure IaaS virtual machines to talk to the rest of that world, and that could be maybe the rest of the world in the public, or it could be your own internal network and the types of things in place. Now, depending on the workloads that you're going to do, there's lots of ways to connect your on-premise environment to Azure, but in most cases, depending on what you're going to be doing from a security standpoint, it might require some official hardware to set up the VPN tunnels. So endpoints are really how we can control that communication and what can actually occur with inside that, because without the open endpoints, you can install everything on that server and really nothing's exposed except for your remote desktop protocol. And when I talk with IT pros, and Brian, I don't know, maybe you can validate this when you talk to developers, this is probably one of the most frustrated things. Like, oh, I've set up my web server, but I can't connect to it. Well, have you created the endpoint? Created my what? And then you have to step through the process. They're very easy to do. Any other tidbits to add on the endpoints, Brian?
Well, load balanced here, you have, yes, that's important. So here you're running two IIS servers, and so these are, you know, virtual public ports that are inbound, and I can configure them so that it's not a direct inbound port, but it goes through the load balancer. So that way I'm splitting load across those two web servers.
Yeah.
And that's pretty common when you want to try to scale to sit behind a load balancer.
Now, my understanding of the load balancer there, Brian, and verify my thinking here, is the load balancer that we have here is a real basic one. It's a round robin. Now, the network and the hardware that's running in our data center is anything far from basic, from load balancing and what occurs in the actual data center. But this is really just kind of a round robin load balance environment. So you might be thinking, well, I can do all these fancy things with my NICs. Well, remember, we're just talking about that virtual system of how these systems bounce back and forth. All the load balancing and the hardware is done by us and done by inside of our data centers.
Yeah, I mean, it's an intelligent round robin. For example, I have lots of people who will set up two web servers like this and hit it 100 times with their laptop and go, well, every time I went to the same server. Well, yeah, because 100 hits in 10 seconds isn't nearly enough to trigger any advanced load balancing features. And our load balancer will try to route you back to the same server over a persistent connection because it's more performant to do that versus tearing that down and creating something new and letting it through. So it's not sticky, but it does favor when it can to send you back to the same server to make things more performant.
Yep, and that's the kind of amazing things you can do. I mean, the endpoints, just think about how hard it is to set up a load balance endpoint today, and here it's a matter of just checking a box and saying this is load balanced. Let me see if my system's actually provisioned. It actually might have gotten lucky, Brian. It might be moving really fast today.
Boom.
Hey, it looks like we're running.
Oh,
yeah. Let's give it a try. So it looks like
don't click restart. Ooh, you almost clicked restart.
I almost clicked. I hovered over. I teased you a little bit.
Okay.
I'm going to go ahead and click on connect. And just to show you what this looks like, to show you how this connection works. So I'm going to create a connection into this box, and this is where I hope I remember the password that I had to type in several times into this virtual system. So hopefully we got this one right. Oh, it looks like we're going to be good to go. I'm just going to go ahead and say yes. You know, Brian, explain to me why is it not trusted? I mean, I trust Azure. It's Microsoft. Doesn't it just have...
you know, I don't know. I think it's because these are self-signed certificates, and when it says not trusted, that's because it's not from, you know, any of the five root certificate authorities. You know.
Well, and that's just it. That's where
it's not publicly signed.
And if you want to have public certificates, you can do all that as well. But notice I'm coming up. It's doing the final configuration components of Windows Server 2012. So, Brian, I'd even say this is probably less than 10 minutes today. And that's normally what you can expect. It's a quick way to stand up the operating system. I'm going to let it come up here, make sure I get into my desktop, and you can just see what we created here, folks. And then we'll hop on out, and Brian and I will wrap up our conversation today. But this is what Azure IaaS brings to the table, the power and the ability to stand up a server. Now, in this environment, what can this server do? Well, it's up to you. What is this server doing now? Not really anything but being a server, being an operating system. It's up to you to bring its code, whatever code or application data you have, install whatever necessary services you would go through and install, just like any other virtual server. And if you look at this, folks are like, wait, man, I did this on my own on-premise. It's exactly the point. This is just a virtual server that happens to be running up inside the Azure data center, but I still have to go through and configure, add roles and features, manage this box, use all my administrative tools and all my other power just to get inside of that environment. So as you can imagine how quick it is to set this up, even if you are a developer, what a great way to get a quick dev and test environment set up that is disposable. It's like, hey, I want to go break something. I want to go test something, and I don't want to mess up my production boxes. Azure provides an environment, but if you want to make this in a full production environment, it's a full production server, and it's up to you to maintain it. As Brian says, give it a hug at night and let you know that you appreciate it, and it's going to run perfectly fine for you. But this is just a server like any other servers that we have in the environment. So I'm going to go ahead and just close this down. And if you don't believe me, by the way, I can go add rules and features and come through and actually step through the wizard. So like would any other server and install them. Now, the only role that you can't really install, and it's because you're running on top of Hyper-V, is Hyper-V itself. If I try to install it, it's going to make me think like it's going to be successful. And then it's going to say, hey, you're already running on top of a hypervisor. But if you want to install, you know, Active Directory services up here, you can do that. If you want to install IIS, you can do that. This is your server, folks, and don't ever forget that. It's just another virtualized environment running inside of there. So I just want to give you a quick tour of the Windows Azure IaaS environment, how to set up a virtual machine. So as you saw, it's really easy to stand up an Azure virtual machine, and within the context of 10 minutes, we're able to do that. So as you look at Azure IaaS, it provides really a strategic initiative for you as an IT pro and even developers to really take your company to the next level. Brian, any parting shots?
Well, you know, it's a really great way to try some dry runs. If you're going to do an upgrade in your environment, why not move that environment temporarily to the cloud, kind of like a clone? Try it out, see if it's going to work, and then do the real thing in your own environment.
So not only does it provide that wonderful trial environment, if you want to leave it up there and make it your permanent kind of residence, it's definitely going to be there for you as well. So with that, I'm going to say thank you for signing in. Listen to Brian and I talk about Windows Azure IaaS.